So far, what we've done is to say, let's develop a picture of with the block equations. To describe what happens to a generic qubit. And of course, the dynamics of this are pretty simple, and we saw that. And then we looked at noise, and we saw that there can be noise from an incoherent distribution in delta omega. I didn't tell you, but there can be noise in omega 1. Recall that omega 1 was tied to a synthesizer, and a synthesizer always has phase noise. And so there's some probability that it will drift in frequency. It's a very small amount of noise, but of course, if we're building a quantum computer, we care about every little bit of noise. It always shows up. And since we have an amplifier, there's always going to be amplitude fluctuations there. It turns out that this piece is almost always slow, just like the incoherence is often slow. And so it actually doesn't limit the quality of a gate that we would apply. It does limit the complexity that if I know that the amplitude is going to vary over some range, then I need to design a gate which is robust for that. And the methods tend to be very much like the methods that we saw for delta omega. Remember that we drew a composite pulse. So instead of having one pulse, there was three pulses whose action mimicked that of one pulse. But it was more robust. Now, of course, there's noise over on this side, right? The effect that we have these relaxation times is due to noise. And we wrote out the spectral density of noise. And I stated, without proving it, that the spectral density, so this is the amplitude of noise at a given frequency, typically has a 1 over F piece and then a white piece. White just means that the amplitude is independent of noise. And it's rare that there's not some resonances in your system. Something that has a characteristic frequency that you couple into. And we want to look a little bit more at this piece. And I'm going to do that tomorrow. But remember, we already looked at just applying X noise or XY noise. And what we saw was that this T2 came from the T1. Now, there's an additional piece of T2 called T2 star, which we normally associate with this incoherence. But I like it better just to say we have incoherence, we can calculate this for every frequency. Okay. So we'll see that. But today I want to talk about how we control gates, how we construct gates for the system. And if I think about the gates, I need to give you a Hamiltonian for more than one qubit. So we want to say that we have two qubit gates. And I leave you with the promise that if you can look at two qubit gates, you can look at n qubit gates. There's no difference. Okay, so we have a Hamiltonian. And our Hamiltonian is going to have two terms to it. So we'll have one term that says every qubit is distinct. And now here, I'm imagining I have some n qubits. And so sigma z sub I is equal to the identity tensor where this is in the ith place, right? And so instead of having to write out the identities, we simply drop them and say, yes, every operator is defined over the full Hilbert space, and therefore add in however many identities you like. And so this says that the resonance frequency of every spin is unique. And over here, we say that there's a coupling between the spins. And I give you two forms of that coupling, a sigma z coupling, which is often you'll hear described as an Ising coupling, and a sigma dot sigma coupling. So of course, sigma dot sigma is sigma x, plus sigma y, all right. Now let's look at a molecule and see if we can understand where these come from physically. So if I look at this molecule thiophene, and if I focus on just the two protons, so you'll recall from your chemistry class that there's supposed to be a carbon at each of those, and we don't draw the carbons. Okay? So it's a five-member ring of carbons and one sulfur. If I look at these two protons, it's easy to see that they are chemically different from each other. Therefore, they're magnetically different. And the reason that we have a variation in delta omega is that the nucleus is surrounded by an electron cloud. And if I put the electron cloud in a magnetic field, then just via Lenz's law, the electric cloud is going to get distorted in such a way as to cancel the field that's inside that cloud. So it will try to suppress the flux lines. And electron cloud, of course, has to respond to chemistry. So it can't do that very well. But it can change the field on the order of parts per million. And parts per million is an easily observed influence. So this is called the chemical shift. And it's a shift of delta omega on the order of parts per million of the original resonance frequency, omega naught. So remember that we were talking about, for instance, having omega naught of 10 tesla. Omega naught is 10 tesla, then the resonance frequency for protons is 400 megahertz. And then the shift between these two, if it was one part per million, it would be 400 hertz. Okay, so 400 hertz is easily observed, right? So this piece says, yes, every spin is different. By every spin, I mean every spin in the molecule. Of course, we have lots of copies of this molecule. Each molecule looks exactly the same. And then here, we have a coupling. And this piece is called the scalar coupling. Now, it's not surprising to you, I hope, that if you have two spins, they're two little magnets. They should couple, right? Every time you've brought two magnets together in your life, they've either attracted or repelled. And so the fact that these are two little magnets say, yes, they should attract or repel. But I'm going to ask you to do as a homework assignment to say, let's take two spins. Let's allow them to tumble because we're in a liquid. So let's allow them to sample every possible orientation. And what you'll see is that the average of this through space coupling goes to zero. And so this term can't be through that from that through space coupling. And what it comes from is a polarizability, so-called Fermi contact term, that I have a molecular orbital that spans these two. And so the nuclear spin polarizes the electron spins in that molecular orbital, which then polarize the electron, the nuclear spin over here. So it's an electron-mediated coupling of the two nuclear spins, which is a mechanism called a Fermi contact mechanism. And because it's mediated through the molecular orbital, this is not the, is independent of the magnetic field. There'll be a nice result come Wednesday where we'll show you that even when you take this term, which of course is dependent on the magnetic field, to zero, you can still do quantum computing just with this term. Okay? Yeah, I'll get to you in 1 second. And so we have this scalar coupling that's mediated. And the strength of the scalar coupling is the overlap of the electron spin and the nucleus. And you'll remember, again, from your chemistry or physics classes, that the only orbitals that have an overlap at the origin are S orbitals. Everything else has a node there. So you can calculate this coupling. It's pretty easy to calculate, in fact. And it depends upon what's the contribution of the molecular orbital, what's the S orbital contribution of that molecular orbital at these two locations. Once you know that, then you know the coupling. Okay? All right, you had a question.
What is the name of that molecule?
Thiophene. It's actually dibromothiophene. Okay. So now then, we have our Hamiltonian, and we can start to ask, can we do quantum computing with it? Now, I want to add two pieces here. One, we saw that when we had the Karp-Russell sequence, so I gave a pi pulse, let's say about y. So that's the Karp-Russell sequence. And normally we would put the spins in the xy plane, but I don't care about that right now. I just want to look at this sequence. So we have this Karp-Russell sequence, and we can think about, well, what is the effect of applying it to this Hamiltonian? Well, we saw already that when we applied a pi pulse, we're applying a pi pulse about the x or y axis, it takes sigma z to minus sigma z. And so therefore, it made it look like during this window, that first term would be evolving positively, during this window negatively, during this window positively, and I average over those, and the term goes to zero. Okay, so the Karp-Russell takes delta omega on average to zero, But now I want to make it, I want to indicate that I'm applying the pi pulses to both spins. And now you see something really nice, I hope. That this term doesn't go to zero. Because if I rotate z1, the first z, by 180 degrees, I pick up a negative sign. If I rotate the second one, I pick up another negative sign. And of course, then this term remains. So this does not change the sigma z term of the Hamiltonian. So now then, I can say, ah, this is great. I have sigma z here. So if we said, well, what control elements do I have? Well, certainly I have H. Nature gave me that. And then I have H of just the coupling. And I'm just going to keep the ZZ term for now. And because all of these frequencies are unique, then I can rotate any one spin at a time. Remember that we talked about the effective field of a spin. So that I said, effective field. So now we're back to one spin. And we would say, oh yes, if the spin rotates, then I have some interaction omega 1 along the x-axis. And I have a term here, delta omega along the z-axis. And the spin is going to rotate about that axis, right? So what do? We say, if I want to rotate spin 1, I'm going to take delta omega for 1 equal to 0. I can choose that because I can choose the transmitter frequency anywhere I want. Then I'll have a whole range of other delta omegas. So delta omega sub I is not equal to 0 for all I not equal to 1. And I'm going to set omega 1 to be much, much smaller than all of those. And now, for the system I want, the effective field is along the x-axis. It'll rotate the spin. For the spins I don't want to rotate, the effective field will be very close to the z-axis. And so I'll only look like I'm adding precession. It'll only look like I left this term right alone. And so we can come very close to having a pulse on only spin 1. And if we're worried that very close isn't good enough, then I can replace it, use the same Hahn echo trick, and replace it with this pulse. And then I get even closer. And then if you tell me this isn't enough, I can do this twice. And we can improve it to any fidelity you desire, we can achieve it. So we have this, and we can rotate any spin by itself about x or y or anywhere in that plane. Yeah. It's the frequency that couples two spins. Okay, so now that we have these controls, we say, oh, I have the drift Hamiltonian, I have the coupling Hamiltonian, I can rotate any spin. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Take that Hamiltonian, apply that sequence, this term will go away, this term remains. They take the average of the action over this time. And so I don't have to introduce the term Heisenberg. Okay? Take the average of the operation over that time. Okay. So now we have our control elements. And we ask the question, do we have universal control, right? This is one of David DiVincenzo's requirements. He says, do you have a complete set of gates? What he's asking is, can you go anywhere in Hilbert space? If you start someplace in Hilbert space, can you go anywhere else? Or in other words, if I have an operator, can I convert that operator into any other operator? And here, it's easy to see that if I have a rotation of a spin, then I can take sigma z, and I can sandwich it by a rotation. Let's say that I sandwich it with a pi over 2 x pulse about the a spin. Let's call that a and b. The spins are independent of each other. They're distinct. So these pulses aren't going to affect that spin. And so this will now lead me to that operator. And similarly, I can create any operator. So any two-body operator can be created this way. Okay, and so we start to show, in fact, at this point, we've shown that we have universal control over two spins. That there's, with just this Hamiltonian and those control elements, we can do anything over two spins. Okay. I want to do two more things. First, let's just look at an example. So let's start here, and I'm going to drop again the identity part of the density matrix and look at the reduced density matrix. Because, of course, the identity part is only going to transform into the identity part. So I'm not so interested in that. So if I start off with sigma z a, then here I'm going to rotate this into sigma x a. So now, just the simple rotations we've seen before. And now I just want to look at how this is going to evolve under the operator sigma z a, sigma z b. Okay, so this bilinear operator describing the Fermi contact term up there. And of course, we remember that there's an identity operator on the B spin because we're in a Hilbert space of 2. It's useful to remember a definition I've already given you, that we have these idempotents or projectors. And of course, the nice thing of them is that E plus minus times E plus minus is equal to E plus minus, and E plus minus times E minus plus is equal to zero. And so just to make the algebra as complicated as possible, I expand out the terms in terms of these idempotents. And of course, here I'm going to do the same thing. And it doesn't hurt, it's even useful to remember that there's a frequency here. So let's call it frequency AB. Now if I now apply this, we see that actually we have two terms in the equilibrium density matrix. We have the A spin in a coherent superposition of spin up and down, conditioned on the B spin up, and then there's a second contribution conditioned on the B spin down. And here we say, oh yes, if the A spin is coupled to a B spin pointing up, then the frequency shows up positively. And if the A spin is coupled to the B spin pointing down, then it shows up negatively. And so our dynamics, and let me just draw this, no, I'll draw it in three dimensions. So we started off with the A spin here, and of course the B spin is either down or up. So those small arrows are supposed to be the direction of the B spin. It's either down or up. And the B spin will rotate this way or this way, because the sign of that precession depends upon which the orientation. And if I wait a nice time, so if I take this and we wait a time that is 2 over omega AB, pi over omega AB, we end up in this state that has this correlated two-spin state. So I started off in a state where there was no correlation, right? That regardless of the states of the B-spin, the A-spin was pointing in the same direction. And by evolving under a bilinear operator, I end up in this correlated state, and what we've shown is that IX identity under sigma z evolves into IY sigma z. Okay. So now then, not only do I show you over here that we can generate, that we can take any two-body interaction and generate any other two-body interaction from it, but here we show that we can take a single-body term and create from it a two-body term. Let's do one more thing. I'm going to put here a pulse of sigma x for the A spin. following that. So we chose this nice time, omega over pi over omega. And so we started here, and then we have this pi over 2 pulse about A, about X. And we end up in that state. So this process looks like a controlled NOT gate. We started off over here. Maybe I should draw that just to make sure that we're all on the same page. I started off over here with both the spins along the z-axis. And then by applying the sequence of pulses, I created the state where I rotated only those A spins that were coupled to the B spin being down. And so this looks like the unitary of sigma x A E minus B plus identity on A E plus B, which is a controlled NOT gate. So we can do gates. We knew that. We have universal control. You'll go through and show that this is almost true, except there's going to be a couple phases. So if I go through and try to define a unitary by following one operator, then, of course, there are many unitaries that will take one operator to another operator. And by a controlled NOT gate, we ask for something a little bit more. We say, not only do I want this operator to go to that operator, but I want to define how every operator is transformed. And, of course, this piece does define how every operator is transformed. Right? This is the correct propagator. But this to here, we dropped some phases. So let's see how we can do it correctly. Okay? And now I'm going to grab my notes, otherwise I'll make a mistake. Perfect. I'm going to use one more property of an idempotent. I haven't bothered to write this for a Hilbert space. It's actually a much more general. So A doesn't need to be complex, and it's also true. The only requirement is that A commutes with E plus minus. And I'll ask you to prove this. I'll give you the promise that it's bloody easy. If you'll just expand the exponential, then the proof is complete. Okay. So now I'm going to start with the unitary. And I've flipped A and B, but this is a perfectly good control knot, so I'm going to describe it this way. And I'm going to take this state, and now I'm going to rewrite it in a way that this makes our life a little bit easier. So it's pretty easy to see that this is the same term, right? That here we get this term back, and here we get this term back, and the cross terms, of course, all go to zero. But the reason I want to write it this way is I want to use this relationship. So now, having written it in this fashion, I can rewrite each of these terms by the rules up there. And you'll ask where this pi over 2 came from. So let me just remind you that e to the I e minus a theta, of course, is equal to this. And so for theta is equal to pi over 2, then that here is equal to I. And so we get the relationship we want, right? So the fact that I have an I here tells me that I want a rotation angle of pi over 2. Okay. Now, look at what's happened. Here, we defined a map. And it's tempting, given a map, to say, oh, if I want a control sequence, what I should do is take the log of it and come up with a Hamiltonian. But, of course, that's not unique. It's a mess in general. And it doesn't necessarily connect at all to the control elements that we have in the system. So we have a universal set of control elements, but it doesn't mean that we have that we can apply instantaneously every Hamiltonian in the system. They're two different statements. So we have a map here. And here, we have a set of rotations. So we've taken our map, and now we've decomposed it into a set of operations. And I'm going to further decompose that by just expanding out E minus. So this term now becomes, and I'll write it out for my notes to get it right. Okay, so now I've just expanded E minus into the identity minus sigma z. And now we have four rotations. Notice that this term is just a global phase. And so provided that, we're living in this two-qubit space, we can drop it. Of course, if we were living in a larger Hilbert space, we may have to consider that, right? Because then it would no longer be global. But if we're living in SU2, then we can drop that one. Notice also that all of these terms commute. And so we're free to reorder them any way we like. And so that is going to be another nice feature of using this approach, which is called geometric algebra. Yeah, you have a question. So somewhere on the board, here, on top there, I define E plus minus for you. I just use those definitions. Okay. So if I can reorder, let me choose an ordering that I like. Okay, so now then we have our sequence. Now there's a couple of additional things that's worth saying. In the controls things, we said that we could rotate an individual spin about x or y. So we didn't say that we could rotate an individual spin about z. So we replaced that term. And I replace it here with e to the minus I sigma xa pi over 4 e to the minus I sigma y, that's an x, a pi over 4 e to the I sigma xa pi over 4. I pointed to the wrong thing. It's here. And similarly, we have this bilinear term here, sigma z, sigma x. But we already saw how to deal with that. We sandwich it by pulses on the x. And so this thing here becomes e to the minus I sigma y b. Pi over 4, e to the I, sigma z, a, b, pi over 4, e to the I, sigma y, b, pi over 4. And now you're telling me it's tedious, and I agree with you. We have a bunch of operations. And notice, each of these operations now, let's take this one. Well, that's pretty easy, right? That says it's a pi over 2 pulse about the minus x-axis for the B-spin. Right? And so we can go through and assign each of these exponents to a rotation. And I won't do it because there's one more piece of physics I want to show you today. But I will write out the full pulse sequence that gets all of the phases correct. And now I'm going to change. No, I won't. It'll confuse you. I'll show you what I'm going to do in a second. Okay. So we have these three, we have this pulse sequence that says rotate the spin, allow it to evolve under the scalar coupling, and then give these three pulses. And naively up here, we said, well, it had to be something like rotate the spin. Now I apologize. Up there, I did a different control NOT gate, right? Up there, I'm rotating the A spin. Down here, I'm rotating the B spin. But just flip A and B. And so you see that, in fact, we get something that's very, very close to what's there. It has exactly the same functionality, but there's a couple extra pulses to take care of the phases. And now we have our perfectly defined control NOT gate. And this stuff is easy to automate. You don't have to you don't have to discover this each time you want to have a gate. You can program this once, and every time you want a gate, it'll spit out the piece. Now there's some optimization. Unfortunately, there's an infinite number of gates that pulse sequences that work for the same gate, right? And so you can optimize getting one. Now over there, we looked at the U for a control knot. And the other really important gate for two qubits is the swap gate. You have a question? Oh, here.
The plus minus on the right hand side, E plus minus.
Yeah? This one? Yeah? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like so. Thanks. Okay, so now we have this swap gate, which says, let's take two spins and invert them. And of course, when you look at the unitaries, it's always a map of telling you what to do, right? And if the, so, you know, this one here on the diagonal says that the two spins are up, you swap them, you get the same state. And this one says if the two spins are down, you swap them, you get the same state. It's only if they're up or down or up, that swapping the definitions of them matter, hence the swap gate. I'm going to give you another wonderful idempotent in SU4. So it has all the same properties that we had before of an idempotent. And it's easy to show that E plus looks like that, and E minus looks like that. So now let's take this idempotent and now describe the action of the gate. So U is equal to E plus AB. We leave it alone, right? That's out here. And we apply sigma x's. To AB. Yeah. It's in a space defined by two spin one half particles, right? So it's yeah, space defined by two particles, 2 spin 1 half? It doesn't have to be. Let's talk after class, okay? So now then, we have this piece. And now let's go ahead and expand this, just like I did over there. Okay, so this is now, again, if we multiply these two, we'll get this one. And we've multiplied these two, of course. We get that one. The cross terms go to zero. And again, we can apply this rule. And when we do, we'll get the term that looks like so now we're back to having a set of rotations. We just write out E plus minus. I'm just going to expand E minus for us here. And so we end up having E to the I sigma x a b pi over 2 times e to the I sigma x a sigma x b sigma z b pi over 2 e to the I pi over 2. There's a global phase that hangs out. There. And you'll recognize that this we can write as sigma YA, sigma YB. Right? You get the term that looks like for each of those minus I, but it all comes out in the wash. I drop the global phase. And so at the end, we see that we get the very nice compact result that the generator of a swap gate is just sigma dot sigma. And so now then we have a nice compact way of understanding how information is flowing through our system. Okay. Now, I'll have to save it for tomorrow, but this is particularly important, as you'll see in your tutorials, that over here, that term is the term that actually appears in the Hamiltonian if we don't make any assumptions. And so nicely, we directly have in the Hamiltonian are generators of a swap gate already. Okay, so let's stop there, and then we'll continue looking at relaxation tomorrow.